But the nice thing about the tool belt or the toolbox is you have plenty of options and tremendous flexibility to improve your biological integrity of your field.
This is the Yara Crop Nutrition Podcast. Yara is the global leader in crop nutrition knowledge and the leading producer of quality fertilizer products. The podcast is intended to facilitate the transfer of knowledge for farmers and crop advisors, improving farm profitability and environmental sustainability. With Yara, knowledge grows.
Thanks for joining another edition of the Yara Crop Nutrition Podcast. My name is Scott Warr, and as we've been talking for a few years now, we all are trying to aspire to be the best sustainable farmers and advisors that we can. And when we do that, we want to start with the basics or start with a good foundation. And that foundation is the soil. A few weeks ago, we had Dr. Carl Wyant, who is the VP of Ag Science at Helier Ag. And did I get it right this time? Helier?
You sure did. Thank you.
Excellent. And he talked to us a little bit about soil quality and soil health. And he has written a couple articles that we'll link in the show notes. And there are really three components to good soil quality and good health. Two of them that we talked about on the last episode were the physical and the chemical. So if you didn't catch that one, also be a link to that podcast. You can go back and listen to that. But this one, we want to get into the biological, the third leg of the stool, if you will. Do you mind if I make that metaphor there, Carl?
That's great. That's perfect.
Three-legged stool. So before we get going, let's review a couple things. What is the difference between soil quality and soil health?
That's a great question. And a lot of folks use them synonymously, and they use them as interchangeable terms. But of course, in science, they like to be very specific with definitions. I like to think of these NRCS USDA definitions. I like to think of soil health as really thinking about the biological integrity of a soil. How alive is your soil? You know, how teeming with microbes, you know, to borrow a popular book title, how teeming with microbes are your soil? Soil quality is a little bit different, and soil quality refers more broadly to how a soil does its job. So think about a farm soil. A farm soil has a specific job to hold plants, to provide an anchor for those plants, substrate for those plants, and not ultimately a place to produce a crop. So we can measure how well a farm soil does its job, and that's different from a forest soil or a prairie soil, different jobs, and there's ways to measure the quality therein.
How do they relate to each other? Are they interchangeable?
Not interchangeable, but definitely related on a Venn diagram for the enterprising listener who wants to draw a Venn diagram of soil quality and soil health. But it's hard to have good soil quality. It's hard to have a soil that can optimally perform its job if it doesn't have the living component, that biological integrity or soil health component that I just mentioned. So if you have sterile soils or soils that aren't very alive, you're not going to be able to get the job done and support the soil quality that you need. So they're related. They're kind of like a Venn diagram or a rushing nesting doll. I don't know, however you want to kind of explain it in your head.
Rob Mickelson's over there. I see him sketching on his legal pad, drawing Venn diagrams, even as we speak. Rob, thanks for joining us. Tell us a little bit about your experience. How does a grower understand whether they have good soil quality and then whether they have good soil health? Where do they start?
Well, Carl mentioned nicely how soil health and quality are related, but they're really different things. And Carl spent much of his career working in the southern desert of Arizona, where there's very little biological activity. Some of those soils are almost like sand dunes. So as a soil health assessment, we might say they're not particularly healthy because there's not a lot of biological activity. But when we manage them properly, it's almost like using hydroponics. So the quality is there. We can make them very productive, but it takes a lot more work than in a soil that's very fertile. and can contain moisture, has a lot of biological activity. So we can make a soil that maybe not the healthiest soil into a productive soil that still has high quality. So there's management that we can do to make these soils productive, but if we're starting from a place where they're already productive, it's much easier. And so what I wanted to talk to Carl today about is how do we improve the soil health and make these soils even more productive? Are there things we can do? Are there management techniques that farmers can follow to boost the quality, the productivity, and the sustainability of their soils?
That was very well stated. I was thinking, how are we going to lead into this, Rob? And you just nailed it on the head. So I guess my first question is, and I think you answered it, Rob, but then we'll push it over here to Carl, is a good quality soil could be that doesn't have the biologicals in it, making it a healthy, productive environment. Can we do things to make it or to change it so that it does have good health? Carl, what do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I think as an industry, we've really focused on chemical management of soils. And that's where we talked last time about calcium programs to help improve aggregation and to displace salts. You can certainly employ a physical soil management program and just think of all the implements that you can either use or even not use, depending on your soil quality goals. And I think it's the biologicals piece that's the new frontier. And that's where this big open road here is to go down and really take those microbes and the soil bacteria, soil fungi, and use the plant roots and put them to work to improve your ground and improve what's happening on your field. And this is where I think a lot of folks it's so new to them. The management techniques are so new that they're just kind of starting to dip their toe in the water on this side and explore what's possible for their own operation.
In the article, you go into some of the options that are available to increase those biological aspect of the soil. What are they? And then we can dive into them specifically.
I think this article that Carl's referring to that he recently wrote is really timely. There's so much interest now in how do we improve our soils? What do we do? And you can hardly open a farm press magazine or newspaper without reading about cover crops, about regenerative agriculture, about soil health. So I think Carl's helping to focus a lot of this energy on this very important topic. So it's very timely, and it's time for a renewed look at some of these practices.
And let's maybe start a metaphor here for us, because I'm a simple-minded guy. We have a tool belt, let's say, okay? We're wearing a tool belt as a farmer, and there's different tools that we can use to improve the biological aspect of the soil. And you're going to tell us right now, Carl, what tools do you have in your belt?
Yeah, let's get into the toolbox here. So one thing you can do on your farm to boost your biology is to feed the microbes. There's a lot of great research that's recently come out showing that a lot of your microbes are starving and they need food. And if you provide them that food source, and that can come from microalgae, molasses, fish products. If you give them a meal, you can wake them up out of dormancy and put them to work for you. It's a really easy way to and convenient way to boost your soil biology. Another common method is growers are out there adding biology to their soil, and this is usually by way of a living inoculant. So this is a bacteria or a fungi sourced from elsewhere, grown in lab conditions or a fermenter. Some folks have some elaborate compost tea and worm tea extraction operations that they can get these living inoculants from. And they add actual living bacteria and fungi back to the soil. And so that their hope is that they can derive whatever function they're going after. You can pick specific groups and get a specific function. Just to do a contrast here, a trichoderma fungi, that's a great way to add a more of a defensive play to your soil and add a fungi that can help with some of the disease suppression. And this contrasts with something, say, like a bacillus bacteria that's much more involved with releasing nitrogen, phosphate, and potassium in the soil itself. So you can kind of pick and choose your living inoculant based on what you're trying to get done, and that provides some tremendous flexibility. One challenge we have with the living inoculants is keeping them alive. They have to remain alive from the where they're produced to where they're stored, and then when they get applied on the farm. And that can be very difficult some years with changing weather conditions and transport issues and container ships getting hung up in the port of Los Angeles. You know, all kinds of crazy stuff's been happening. So it's important that if you're going to choose a living inoculant to make sure that you've got one that's alive going on your soil. And it seems like such a simple rule to go by, but it can kind of catch people off guard if they're putting out something that's no longer viable.
Carl, real quick, let me just ask a silly question. I assume these are microscopic. So, you know, if you have a 40-acre field and you want to add more biologicals, does it come in a little tiny bottle and you throw it up in the wind and let it spread? I mean, what does this look like and how is it applied?
Yeah, they're often liquid form, or they can be in a dry form, say like a granular inoculant. So you can apply it through a traditional rig. You know, you can knife it into the soil. You can run up through the water. You can put it out through an air seeder if you have a dry product. So they typically fit into current ag implement logistics. It is a challenge because you can't see if it's alive or not. And that's where if you want to confirm, is my product living on the inoculant side, that's where having a good relationship with the lab where they can plate out stuff and tell you, hey, this is the actual count of the product versus what's stated on the label.
And Carl, I might just mention, I think we have a lot to learn still about which specific bacteria and fungi are the most impactful in the soil. We can measure many of these bacteria and many of the fungi, but to say this one is responsible for this function or that function, it's really an exciting area, and the advances in soil microbiology are really increasing fast, but I don't think we're quite at the point yet where we know exactly which microbes are the ones that are going to get us to the promised land.
Yeah, that's a great point. There's millions of species below ground. Very few of them are actually available to cultivate in mass, you know, in some of these fermentation systems and tea production systems. So we have a few that we can work with, but one of the challenges is that if you're going to pick an inoculant, you pick just a couple of different species that we know some things about. There's a lot more to be learned here moving forward. But one thing about really, I'd say, feeding the local microbes, the microbes that are adapted for your climate, for your soil, if you simply provide them the meal, you can wake up all that diversity in the field that would otherwise be impossible to put, you know, in a bug in a jug format because of all the different species that are unable to be cultivated outside of the soil environment itself.
Carl, I like the way you put that. I recently spent some time in Africa, and in some of those countries, there are very degraded soils. They've been eroded. They're highly acid. They've been cropped for centuries without any nutrient replacement to speak of. And in some of those areas, we go and say, well, let's put fertilizer on. And so we do that, and the crops still don't grow. The nutrients are all there, but like you mentioned, the biology is not there. So when we add some organic matter, some nutrients, and some manure or compost, all of a sudden it's like the switch went on. That now there's food for the microbes, the soil health is improved, and now the roots can grow and take up those nutrients. So I really like the way you say, let's wake up the microbes that are there by giving them the food, and then they can take advantage of all the other goodies that we provide to the roots.
That's a great observation, Rob. I think that's perfect when talking about this Venn diagram between physical management, chemical management with fertilizers, and then your biological management. When you can put the three together, that's where you see the synergy, where now 1 + 1 + 1 equals, you know, 6 or 7 or some other form of math that's far advanced of my way of thinking. But yeah, it's that missing component, the synergy with the fertilizer, the synergy with the biologicals and all those other management tools that a grower has to in their tool belt.
I'm just curious. I'm putting on my farmer hat again, and I'm thinking, how do I know if I need to use any of these strategies? We've talked about two of the five. How do I know whether I need to use them? Are my yields not as good as they should be? Do I have more disease? How do I know whether I need to test?
Yeah, that's a great place to start. And in the article, I recommend that, you know, if you're new to this biological arena, find a trusted advisor to help, you know, help lower that learning curve and help kind of get you to where you need to go. And the testing is a good part of it. There's plenty of labs out there now that you can send your soil to, get all the traditional chemical measurements and physical measurements, things like pH and phosphate parts per million, salinity characterization. You can get that, but you can also now order tests that tell you how alive is my soil. And that's where you can start, you know, measuring and tracking your progress. You know, you might have a soil that comes back, this is hardly alive. Here's the quantification that supports that conclusion. Implement some practices like I've been describing, and Scott, I have a few more to go through on the tool belt for the listener. But then remeasure those soils a few years later and track those changes. So the testing is rapidly evolving on tracking the biological management, and for a lot of growers and a lot of advisors, this can be a new arena to go into.
Well, let's move down the tool belt. We've uncovered two. One is feed the microbes that are in the soil, the biologicals that are in the soil. Second, add more biologicals in the soil. And what is the next one?
So another one is add mulches and compost. And Rob, this goes back to what you were talking about with your experience in Africa, adding that bulk carbon source that's contained in a mulch or a compost, add it to the soil as a part of your program. And you can add microbial food in a large concentration in that way. You can also add nutrients at the same time, so it can be a kind of a two-for-one practice. Get your microbial food, your bulk carbon, and influence your NPK availability that's contained on the mulch or compost itself.
And we've seen that increase in popularity over the years. As I drive up and down these farmers' roads, I see more mulches and compost is being applied. So I think that's one that's common out there, right?
Right. Yeah, it's probably, I don't know, Rob, you're more of a fertilizer historian than I am, but it's probably the oldest amendment in the book, isn't it? Besides water.
Those have been around for a long time, and I think it's been obvious to everyone how beneficial those are to soil and to crop productivity. One of the problems is there's not enough compost and manure and organic amendments to go around. So those have to be produced somewhere and then harvested to transported to another field. So we're always looking for more organic sources like that, Carl.
Yeah, that's a great point. There's always a drawback. There's nothing in ag. I always tell my folks, there's no free lunch in agriculture. For all the promise of mulches and compost, there's always a drawback. And a lot of it's logistics, getting it to the farm, because you have to transport a lot of material, and you're talking tons per acre. You can have a transport cost, logistics issues there, spreading it. If the compost isn't treated right, you can have issues with weed seeds, salinity. So there's all these other factors that need to be brought into that discussion early on.
And just like fueling your body, there are some things that you can put in your body like high fructose corn syrup or sugar that is really fast, quickly available and gives you a burst of energy. And then there are other slow burning nutrients that we can put in our body that are more of a slow release energy. Is that what you would call these mulches and compost, more of a slow burn energy source?
Yeah, that's a good point. You can relate this to your antimicrobial food tool as well. Carbon chemistry really matters. And if you want to feed the microbes, you know, very quickly within a season, some of these microbial food sources that I mentioned earlier, the microalgaes and such, they have good carbon chemistries that can have an impact immediately. And their breakdown of what's in the food, the lipids, proteins, and the carbohydrates, you know, you can use those to your advantages to influence different abundances and different diversities below ground and kind of wake everybody up, wake the whole soil microbiome up and all that biology you're looking for. On the compost side, much of that material needs to be decomposed and degraded before it can actually be used, you know, the nutrients by the plants themselves. But that carbon isn't all available for your microbes, the actual food source. There's some available, but much of it's already been decomposed over time. It's not readily available. You will have a lag in between applying your mulch and compost and when you'll actually see the benefit below ground.
I might just add, we hear a lot about storing carbon in the soil these days. It seems like it's quite the rage in the news and in politics as well. And so the purpose of storing carbon in the soil is multifold. One is to improve the soil health and soil quality that you talked about. But we hear about it so much now is because we're trying to remove CO2 from the air. We're putting organic matter that contains carbon in the soil, and we want to lock it there for a long time. So as Carl pointed out, some of the carbon we put in there is going to disappear in days or weeks. And then some, like the compost, may last for years or decades. And then other very stable organic matter may last for centuries. And you may hear about biochar as well, which is almost a form of agricultural charcoal. And they're hoping we can put that carbon in the soil and it will last for centuries or more. So Carl was right in pointing out there's many kinds of carbon. We hear about carbon, but it's almost like they're a totally separate entity.
Yeah, there's lots of speeds of carbon. You've got fast gear and then you've got granny gear. And depending on your source, will help you determine how fast is that carbon going to be moved through your system. Good point, Rob.
Let's get into another tool in that tool belt. We talked about the mulches and compost. What's the fourth tool in our tool belt?
Yeah, the fourth tool is cover cropping. So growing a mix or a single species of crop. It's not the cash crop. It's the other stuff, the cover crop. And the cover crops really get a lot of attention above ground, where we can see you put your cover crop in between the rows of the trees or the vines, or you plant it in the off season of an annual crop like corn or soybeans. But these cover crops get a lot of attention above ground for reducing erosion, you know, less material leaving the field from a rainstorm or runoff from snowmelt. If you live out west or in the Great Plains, you're probably worried about wind erosion. So you can keep the soil covered, hence the cover crop. You keep it away from the wind blowing all your hard work and your land assets, you know, into the neighbor's house. So lots of attention for cover crops above ground, but below ground cover crops can produce these extensive root systems. And what they can do is these root systems can leak or exude carbon foodstuffs to the microbes in the soil and feed them. So it's another food source, another way to keep that microbiome fed and keep your soil biological integrity intact. And you can do this in the areas, whether it's the rows between the trees, you know, keep that biology fed across more surface area or farm, or you can do it in time. You can plant the cover crop at the end of the season on an annual crop, say in Iowa, and keep that soil microbiome fed, you know, in the off season and keep it elevated so that when you do need it, it hasn't been starved to death for a number of months.
What are the disadvantages for using a cover crop? You know, as I go and look at a bunch of here in California, I walk a lot of almond fields and citrus fields, and I typically don't see a lot of cover crops. I see it more in pistachios, but why are not more people not using cover crops?
Yeah, great question. I mentioned the advantages of erosion control and feeding your microbes for cover crops. Again, there's no free lunch in agriculture. The disadvantages are the equipment to actually plant the cover crop, and that can be a challenge. So if you're a nut grower, you might not have, actual seed planting equipment. So you'll have to go and get it. That's another expense. And then one of the other disadvantages comes in the termination of the cover crop. When you got to come back into cash crop time and some of the logistics associated, like, with almonds, with you pulling them off the almond field floor, if you have a cover crop in the way, that's going to be a challenge. So terminating the cover crop can provide some challenges to a grower and how they get rid of it so they can clear the way for their actual cash crop operations.
Yeah, Carl, you've covered nicely some of the benefits and some of the limitations of that. I just wanted to insert that I think using cover crops is probably one of the most important things we can do on a practical basis to protect our soils. You're right, they're a hassle, they're expensive, there's lots of challenges with them, but in terms of improving our soil, there's probably no other simple technique that we can use that beats using cover crops. So I'm hoping that we develop new technology, new systems, new agro techniques that'll allow cover crops to be inserted more regularly, because they're sure hard to beat for soil health.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, think of your own lawn at your house, how great that soil looks because you keep a cover crop on it most of the year and then you keep that thatch there, during the wintertime. Same sort of thing with an ag field is keeping it covered, keep it protected. Just got some challenges on the other end where to deal with some of those cons that are associated with the practice.
I'm reminded of some of the benefits coming from soil roots too. I think one of the first times I heard about this concept you're talking about, Carl, is there's a fungi that lives in association with the roots called mycorrhizal fungi. And I learned that they produce a sticky goo sort of called glomalin, which binds those soil particles together. It truly is the glue that helps hold the soil together. And that was my first exposure to this. And Carl, I think the work you're doing shows that when you add a readily available carbon source, there's other organisms that can help make this microbial glue. Is that right?
Yeah, you nailed it. The biology of your soil is so important, not just for helping to release NPK from the organic matter and some of the mineral fractions. But the other piece of having good soil biology is their ability to stick your soil together physically. So they produce these glues, glomalin for the fungi, the bacteria, if you can get a good bacteria population going, they help produce these things called extra polymeric substrates, EPS. And that's like another kind of glue. So you start putting soils back in your glue, or in your soil, you can start to improve the soil structure and aggregation. And now you're well on your way to improving the overall soil health and quality of your farm.
I remember years ago, I was visiting a brand new pistachio planting. And for those of you who are not aware, pistachios take many, many years before they're actually producing and productive. And this one grower did plant a cover crop, but he planted a cover crop that he could make money on. He planted alfalfa. And so it helped offset some of his costs because he was getting multiple crops of alfalfa during the 3 or 4 or 5 years it took to bring these pistachio trees to maturity. Are there other cover crops that are in the money-making category like that? Or are they typically just grasses that you just go in and mow occasionally to keep it under control?
That's a great question. I love that example of using alfalfa in the interim of when your trees start to bear and produce profit. That's a pretty cool way to help ease that transition a little bit. Some folks are using their cover crops as grazing material for livestock. So it's not maybe a plant related profit avenue, but it's, they're using their otherwise empty fields, growing up some forage and helping their livestock have a nice meal on the above ground side.
And you're applying some compost at the same time, right, Rob?
your mobile compost units.
In addition to that, I've seen some of the almond growers around here that cover crop with combinations of clovers and vetches that bloom very early in the spring. and they're providing habitat to improve their pollination during that critical time of the nut set. So that could be another benefit from these cover crops.
Excellent. We have one more tool that you mentioned in the article for our tool belt. What is that, Carl?
Yeah, this is a callback to our earlier podcast about physical management. And again, this relates to tillage. Tillage is hard on soil biology. If you're doing a lot of it, it's like, I always like to explain, it's like a tornado going through your house. You know, how are you gonna make a living with that happening every season? So reducing your tillage not only has an impact on your physical, you know, structure, you can keep more of your soil structure intact and not being sliced and diced, but on the biological end, you can keep more of that biology intact and improve your soil biological integrity just by reducing the physical disturbance.
So we have these tools in our tool belt. We've had the maybe an idea that we need to get our soil tested to see how healthy it is. And we've gone and yes, indeed, we need to improve the soil health. Which tool do we pull out of the belt? Is there one more effective than the other, or do we focus on one rather than the others?
I'd say it's so specific for the operation. You know, it's hard to recommend cover crops to a grower that doesn't have the equipment to put it out. So maybe the feeding the existing biology might be a better solution. Meanwhile, if someone who lives outside that critical radius of being near a dairy might not have access to the mulches and compost, and so that might not be a good option, and maybe cover cropping is a better solution for them. So it really it's operation specific, field specific. But the nice thing about the tool belt or the toolbox is you have plenty of options and tremendous flexibility to improve your biological integrity of your field.
I like the way you put that, Carl, because you start where you can, really.
Yeah.
You don't have to do it all. You shouldn't do it all. But I think everyone can change one small piece. Maybe reduce your tillage intensity. Think about your soil biology for a change. Is there compost? Is there some organic treatment you can add? Is there some carbon you can add? Is there compost or mulch available? What can you do and make a small change to improve that soil health and ultimately the soil quality, which will raise your productivity? Right. So do what you can. Don't jump in and say, I need all five tools at once, but you can pick one and start with that.
Yeah. Yeah. You don't have to do a hardware store shopping spree. Just, you know, just fit the one that get the one that best fits your operation to get started. And I think getting started, Rob, just to echo what you just said, getting started is the key. Pick that lowest hanging fruit that you can use to improve your soil biology.
How long does it take to improve the soil health? Is it a quick fix one season thing, or does it take multiple seasons? Give me an idea.
Great question. So within the soil health testing, menu of tests you can get, there are some that can pick up changes very quickly. So something like the Solvita CO2 burst test, that can give you an indirect measure of microbial activity, and you can detect changes fairly quickly, you know, within a couple of days or so after a treatment. There's other tests, things like soil protein and aggregation, you know, measures of soil structure, or things like active carbon, which is a way to measure the microbial food in the system. You know, those can take longer to pick up. So it depends on how, you know, it depends on the lab that you like to work with and maybe your level of impatience of seeing changes. So some folks love to see the test that they can see it right away. And some folks are more okay with a beginning of season and maybe an end of season measurement. There are some measurements that take a long time to change, and that's things like soil organic matter percentage. Those, if you're an impatient person, watching your soil organic matter percentage change on a soil test can be frustrating, because that takes a long time. That can take years before you start impacting that.
Carl, as you talk about these long-term changes, I am reminded that Yara just launched this very week a new program to store carbon in the soils, and they're currently enrolling farmers throughout North America where they can change some of these practices and receive financial compensation in exchange. Because this is becoming such a global issue, I'm sort of proud to say that Yara is at the forefront, really, to encourage these farmers to store carbon in the soil. And they're assembling a team that will work hand in hand with farmers to accomplish this goal. So I think we're all in this together now.
I was just going to say, Rob, that's a great tease for an upcoming podcast that we're going to have about the Agoro Alliance that Yara just announced this week. I've been promised that we can get some experts on that can talk about how growers can implement some of these strategies and have it offset with some revenue from these programs.
I was just going to say, soil health, soil quality. It's a commitment to a process, and it's going to, just decide what you need to get done that fits your operation. Have your tests ready so you can see that incremental change that you're looking for. And I think having that medium to longer term view is a really great way to think about it. I was thinking we're in this drought here. You know, these growers that have really focused on these soil health practices. One of the key relationships between soil carbon, soil health, and the soil's ability to store moisture is this really nice relationship that, the more carbon you have in a soil, the better your ability to store water. So it's called water holding capacity. And so now that we're in this drought, the growers that have made this investment a few years back into their soil health parameters and improving all these different things that are associated with the biology and the soil structure, things that kind of have been, a little bit forgotten about over time, they're seeing their soils store moisture for when they really need it, and which is right now during the drought. And certainly they'll do they're looking forward to a successful harvest despite all the challenges that Mother Nature's throwing at them.
It reminds me of the old saying, when's the best time to plant a tree? And that's 10 years ago. When's the second best time to plant a tree today?
Yeah.
I think that you're right on the money there that, we've seen droughts in California before, and those that were smart or advised by smart people to improve their soil health are better off today going through this drought that we're experiencing now. But it doesn't mean that you're without hope. You can go and improve your soil health now, and it will help you this year, and it will help you in years to come. So I like what you said. It's a management strategy that is a holistic strategy that takes time.
Yep.
But it's never too late to start.
That's right. I like to think, when's the best time to buy Amazon stock? And it was 1997.
Nationally, when we look at the adoption of no-till, I think that's a real success story on how we're improving soil health and soil quality by reducing the tillage intensity that Carl talked about and leaving that residue on the soil surface. And this wasn't done as a fancy save-the-world soil carbon routine. Farmers saw the practical value in doing this, and that's why it's been so successful, because it translates into better yields and more profit. So these things are not mutually exclusive. So that's what we need to keep working on, is how do we find these win-win situations where the soil benefits and the farmer benefits.
Yeah, great point.
Well, thank you guys. Carl, these two articles, part one and part two, we'll link those in the show notes, but if someone wants to find them, where can they find these articles?
Yeah, these articles are available on the web at progressivecrop.com. You can access it from your phone, from your laptop. If you still get magazines in the mail, you'll find them in issues of Progressive Crop Consultant, and you can read it there and let your neighbor borrow it.
Thank you, Carl. Tell us a little bit about what projects you're working on with Helier, and what do you do there?
Yeah, so I currently serve as the Vice President of Ag Science at Helier Agriculture, and we specialize in turning microalgae products into superior agricultural microbial food. So that's why I mentioned that microalgae before. That's what we do. I've got a lot of really cool projects on deck right now. One of those projects is working on very sandy soils for avocado and blueberry production. And we're using a prescriptive program and leveraging that soil biology to help those growers save water, you know, get the good biology, get the good aggregation, store more water holding capacity. And then that gives that farmer some tremendous capacity to produce more fruit and export more fruit.
Well, we appreciate your efforts out there pushing the envelope and helping our providers, our food providers, maximize what they can produce and in a sustainable way. So, Carl, thank you for joining us again. And when's the next article coming out? Do you have a topic or do you need some ideas?
I have another one coming out in Organic Farmer magazine here probably sometime this summer.
Okay. Well, let us know. We'd love to have you on. I think that my knowledge grows every time I talk to you, and I hope that the listeners also gain some golden nuggets out of our conversation. And if you want to learn more, go to yara.us or yaracanada.ca. Before we end, we want to remind you of the free irrigation scheduling tool, the Yara Farm Water Advisor. Click on the link in the show notes and you can download the app for free and get started today.
You've been listening to the Yara Crop Nutrition Podcast. For more information about our company, please visit us at www.yara.com or yara.us, or for Canada, yaracanada.ca.